From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. The U.S. government has declared a major disaster for the state of Louisiana, specifically in four parishes in the Baton Rouge area, as severe flooding continues. Since the rain began on Friday, at least six people have died and more than 10,000 are in shelters. Here's the governor, John Bel Edwards, speaking today on Good Morning America.
This was a record event, even though it was an unnamed storm. It was historic levels of rivers and creeks rising. And I will tell you that we've not seen anything like this in the past.
Joining us now is Sue Lincoln, who is news director at WRKF in Baton Rouge. And Sue, what's it like there today?
Baton Rouge, the city proper, the center of the city, is an island of sorts, surrounded on three sides by water due to the flooding on the fourth side. We have the levees in the Mississippi River. It is difficult, if not nearly impossible, to get into the city by road in any way right now.
And we know that there have been a number of deaths already. What's happening? Are people driving into the water? Are they just getting trapped?
That was what was happening early on when we had the rain falling so heavily and we had flash flooding going on. People were driving into the water or getting swept away as the road surface crumbled beneath them. There have also been some deaths, we suspect, due to the fact that folks could not get out of their homes because the floodwaters rose so precipitously.
And this is just from a lot of rain, basically.
Basically, it's just from a lot of rain. Now, that main rain system has moved to the west. It's mostly over Texas right now. But we are anticipating pop-up thunderstorms from the heat and humidity this afternoon and every day for the next week.
How typical is this in Baton Rouge? Have you ever experienced anything like this before?
The closest I've experienced was when Tropical Storm Allison sat over us and we saw flooding in places that didn't usually flood. But folks who were here in 1983 say this is similar but much worse. The flood levels are higher than they were in 1983. Everything is off the charts. There's no way to guesstimate even where this water is going to go.
Now, when people hear you talking about this right now, it sounds like everything's fine because you're in a quiet studio and that's what it sounds like. But if you were to walk outside, give us a sense of what things are like there.
If you move to the outskirts of the city in any direction, you will see streets that are filled with water. You will see homes that are underwater. Currently, my oldest daughter and my son-in-law are staying with us because their entire apartment complex was inundated completely. Mm. They're on the ground floor. Water rose to halfway up the second story of that apartment complex. And it was not anticipated. It rose that quickly in less than 12 hours.
So how much help are people like your daughter or other people who have suffered some damage as a result of this, how much help are they getting from the state, from the city, from the federal government?
They're going to be getting an awful lot. FEMA has come in. The federal disaster declaration has been approved for the area. People's homeowner insurance. Many of them did not have flood insurance because they weren't considered to be in a floodplain. That's something that will have to be worked out. But right now, we are still in response mode, very much here in Louisiana. We are still trying to rescue people as these floodwaters migrate south. Right now, Baton Rouge is cut off from the city of New Orleans as well. There's no way to get to New Orleans. So they are going to be able to get help. They can start applying to FEMA for disaster assistance now. But we're still dealing with these big pools of water spreading out and seeking their own level, if you will. And it's coming into subdivisions that had never, ever seen this kind of rain.
And you mentioned New Orleans. Of course, we all remember what happened 11 years ago with Hurricane Katrina and the flooding that occurred in New Orleans. Have there been any lessons learned from that that are being applied right now in Baton Rouge?
One of the lessons is what we call the Cajun Navy. Many folks tried desperately to offer help to rescue flood victims in New Orleans post-Katrina. And we're not able to get in because of security concerns, also because of the situation there and the way New Orleans is structured. But folks have gone out with their boats on trailers into subdivisions, launched their boats, and have coordinated through the wonders of social media, because we were without cell phone service. Those of us who had one particular provider yesterday, we were completely without cell phone service all day yesterday. But they have managed to coordinate, and as they get reports of somebody needs help at this address, folks in their boats were going out and rescuing people in their subdivisions, not even including folks in the more rural areas outside of the city of Baton Rouge proper, going and rescuing folks who were trapped by floodwaters.
That's Sue Lincoln, news director at WRKF in Baton Rouge. Sue, thanks so much.
You're very welcome, Jeremy.
Now to the water crisis in Flint, Michigan. Yesterday, the federal emergency declaration regarding Flint's lead-tainted water ended, but officials rushed to say that residents will still get water bottles and filters. It just means the state will pick up the full cost. And last week, Virginia Tech researchers said there was now no detectable lead in half of the homes that were tested in July. But there is work to do. Pediatrician Mona Hanna-Attisha is with the Hurley Medical Center in Flint. Hi, Dr. Mona.
Hey, Robin. Great to be here.
Well, and just where are we on the crisis? We know there's almost panic on the part of some citizens who, when they saw this August 14th date, thought, that's it, we're not getting help anymore. They are still going to get help, but how much do they need it?
Yeah, they absolutely need it. We are still very much in an emergency. Our water in Flint, Michigan is still not safe to drink. And many people, you know, they haven't heard about Flint as much. They thought this was resolved. The federal emergency is over. People think that we have access to drinking water from our tap. And to this day, we do not.
Yeah, so people still need the filters and they need the bottled water delivered. And your city's mayor, Karen Weaver, says that other things have gotten better. That's the distribution of the water in the filters is more organized. School nurses. I didn't know that there was only one.
Yeah, it was amazing. So before this water crisis, Flint Community Schools had one school nurse. So because of kind of our advocacy efforts, we got 9 school nurses pretty quickly. I mean, we're also about to open up 2 to 3 school-based health centers. So there are some great things happening in Flint, especially for this coming year. We're going to have more slots for preschool. A new child care center is opening up. We have greater nutrition access, but we're very hesitant because a lot of these great things we have funding for maybe for 1 year or 2 years. We don't have that long-term commitment, and this is a long-term problem, and we need decades of resources.
Yeah. Well, where are we on that problem? As you explained to us and as the country came to know, not just in Flint, but in other cities, even a small amount of lead can profoundly damage young people. What are you seeing a couple years out for these children who had the lead in their water?
Yeah, so science has taught us so much about lead, and we now very much know that there is no safe level of lead in a child. The American Academy of Pediatrics reaffirmed this in a recent policy statement, and even those lowest levels that we thought were safe can have significant impacts on a child's cognition and behavior. So what we are seeing in Flint, you know, we will never, all of the research on lead is very much done at a population level in the field of epidemiology. So we can never really prove causation. So if I have a child that I see in clinic today who is newly diagnosed with, for example, a learning disability or ADHD, you know, everybody's blaming everything on the water, but it's really impossible to say, you know, that this was from the water. So we are treating everybody as if they were potentially exposed. Not everybody is going to have problems. We're hoping our children turn out even better than before because of these robust wraparound services we're trying to build in.
When you say you're treating them, what do you do for children that, I mean, it's pretty clear have had lead in their water? What do you do for them?
Yeah, so there is no magic pill. There is no antidote for lead. It's an irreversible neurotoxin. So the cure is never being exposed. So now we have a population that is entirely exposed. So we have to do something in the public health world called secondary prevention, where we try to mitigate the impact of this exposure. And that's very much what we are doing every day. So we are building robust early education systems, robust nutrition systems, robust healthcare systems to wrap these children around to really limit the extent of anything that we may see. Mm-hmm. So science has taught us lead is bad, but science has also taught us that children's brains have this window of plasticity that we can really mitigate a lot of these impacts with, say, universal preschool and early literacy programs and access to a medical doctor and great nutrition.
Well,
we'll
talk about the nutrition for a second, because you told us last time you were starting fruit and vegetable programs and just this idea of even bringing more fresh fruit and vegetables to these kids.
Absolutely, Robin. So in Flint, we have very limited access to great nutrition, which was one of the reasons our kids were hit harder by this. Because if you have poor nutrition, an empty stomach, if you're deficient in certain nutrients like iron, calcium, vitamin C, you absorb lead more readily, which is why kids in many inner cities have higher rates of lead poisoning. So nutrition is so important right now while we have ongoing exposure. But it's also so important to have great nutrition to promote children's brains and to limit re-exposure, because eventually lead gets stored in your bones. And if you have poor nutrition in the future, it can come back out of your bones and cause that neurotoxicity all over again. So my clinic, which is on top of this really cool farmer's market in downtown Flint, it's the only clinic that we know of that's in a farmer's market. We give out nutrition prescriptions. So a kid comes in for a checkup or an ear infection, they get a $10 voucher to go downstairs and get fruits and veggies. So some great programs have come into place to improve children's access to great nutrition.
Although you say the one thing you do need long-term is more funding, more federal funding.
Absolutely.
So we'll keep an eye on that. Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha, Director of the Pediatric Residency Program at the Hurley Medical Center in Flint, Michigan. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Robin.
We received a letter last Thanksgiving from an inmate at Oklahoma's Lawton Correctional Facility. Now, we get a lot of mail from inmates, usually a request to help them prove their innocence, but this man knew he was guilty. He was finishing a prison sentence for having sex with an underage teenage girl, and he was nervous about getting out. It's hard for a sex offender to get a job, to find an apartment, to talk about his crime. But this one wanted to. His name is Juan Guerrero. He told us he used a prison radio to listen to Here and Now. So our Peter O'Dowd wrote back, and soon Peter and Juan started speaking on the phone. They made this call 4 days before Juan was released.
I've been in here, you know, 6.5 years, and you don't know how many people I've seen come back. I don't want that to be me at all. So I'm scared. I'm scared that I'm not going to survive.
So Peter is with us now. He'll be guiding us through this story, which might not be appropriate for children. And Peter, after this call, you go to Oklahoma City to meet Juan. But first, you dug into court documents. So tell us what you found about his past.
Yeah, if there is such thing as a typically bad childhood, Juan had it. He was arrested several times as a kid, stuff like vandalism, stealing a car. So I was very skeptical of this guy. But I was also curious because there are 800,000 registered sex offenders in the United States, and rarely, really, do we ever get a chance to hear from them.
And we want to rush to say right away there are thousands of their victims in the U.S. as well. And you tried to find his, but you couldn't. So we have just one side, the story of Juan. From a town outside of Fresno, very agricultural area. He told you his mother was an alcoholic who worked in the fields. Pick it up from there.
Yeah, in his 20s, he decides to grow up. He moves to Oklahoma City, and he enrolls at the local campus at Oklahoma State University. Now, I found out later that his professors loved him, and he was doing very well at school. He was standing out as a success story, but just when things seemed to be getting better, he makes a terrible mistake.
Right, and we're going to talk more about that. But let's go now to the bus stop in Oklahoma City where you met Juan the day he gets out of prison.
We plan to meet in the morning at the Greyhound station. It's where you'd expect to find a bus depot, at the edge of town, in the middle of America.
Kansas City, Des Moines, Minneapolis, and all point forward. We're about to leave on dock 4.
The bus won't pull up for another 30 minutes, but Danny Hurst is already here.
Of all the students I've had, he's got to be probably in the top five.
Hurst worked with thousands of students in his career. He was the director of a support program at the local campus of OSU that helped low-income first-generation students like Juan. He's retired now, but Hurst remembers that Juan started a nonprofit to wipe out gang graffiti.
The first few weeks and months, he would come in and just study the dictionary because he was trying to improve his English skills. And I'd never seen a student do that.
How are you feeling today, 30 minutes before Juan comes through the door?
Well, I'm extremely anxious. I've got lots of emotions. I love the guy. I believe in the guy. Very emotional, I guess.
Juan's math and English tutor are here, too. They've kept in touch over the years. And when the bus pulls up, Juan steps off wearing prison-issued white sneakers. His teachers rush out to greet him.
There he is.
Oh, he looks great. Hi, you look great, man. You look great.
So wonderful to see you like this.
Everyone's either smiling or crying. English tutor Ann Schenk is relieved to recognize her former student.
I was afraid that your beautiful smile and the the glint in your eye would be gone, but it's not.
My heart is still the way it is, and my smile is still here because of you guys. Without you guys, I would have gave up.
Juan's teachers say they worried about him in prison, and now they worry about where he's going to live. So Danny Hurst went door to door before Juan got out and asked his neighbors, would you mind if my former student moved in?
That was going to be a challenge.
Would it bother you to have a sex offender living next door?
It was difficult. You know, I think most of them know me and kind of trust me and like us as neighbors, but they were very hesitant. About half of them said they preferred him not to stay.
Juan's crime will follow him wherever he goes. On a summer night in 2009, he invited a 14-year-old girl to his house. Juan was twice her age. He worked at a shelter for troubled teens where the victim had been living. They'd known each other for a few months, but nothing had happened between them until that night in July when everything happened. Court documents say Juan got her drunk on beer and vodka.
His job was to counsel juveniles in trouble, but tonight a 29-year-old man is in trouble, accused of raping a 14-year-old. As John Jordan tells us, it's...
So many years later, Juan is out of prison, but worried about his options. With nowhere to go in Oklahoma, he's heading back to California, maybe picking oranges, like his mother did.
It's going to be hard, but what can I do? I remember as a little kid, you know, telling my mom, you know, I don't want to do this my whole life, and... But yet I'm going back to the same thing that she was doing as when I was a kid.
Those are some of Juan Guerrero's first moments out of prison. As we've been telling you, our own Peter O'Dowd contacted him when he was in prison after he wrote us a letter. And these are the events that followed. But Peter, later that day, you tag along as Juan goes to the courthouse to pay some fines. He has to register as a sex offender in Oklahoma City before leaving for California.
Yep.
And as he said, he faces a future of people wondering if he can be trusted. So how is he handling that?
It's interesting. There's actually a lot of research out there that says recidivism rates for sex offenders is actually quite low, lower in many cases than other crimes. But Juan makes the point that it's hard to get back into society. He has to take a polygraph test about his sexual history as a part of his parole. He wears a GPS ankle collar. But at the same time, you can totally understand why there are major concerns about keeping track of sex offenders. In Juan's case, the victim's mother told the court that that night with Juan and the rape changed her daughter. She said that she'd become reticent and then angry, and that she acted differently around older men. And her mother believed that Juan leveraged his position of power at the shelter. When I sat down with Juan and also his ex-girlfriend, Rihanna Lindsay, who stayed with him for some time while he was in prison, Juan fully agreed that he manipulated his victim.
I was letting this power get to me, and I shouldn't have.
I read in the report that she told you, you know, you could go to prison for this while you were sort of in the heat of the moment. And you said, yeah, I know. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I remember that. I should have took that advice, because at the time, you know, nobody thinks they're going to get caught for what they're doing, you know, and when you're drinking. And I should have took her advice. You know, maybe she was more mature than myself.
People will want to know, because of your status now, like, was this a one-time thing? Was this something that you, like, is this like a desire that you have in you forever? Like, I mean, what do you think, and how do you explain that to people?
Yeah, no, I mean, this is not a desire that I have, you know? I mean, I don't ever want to do this again. You know, I guess at the same time, too, I didn't think it was an expensive deal where I got, you know, 9 years, you know? I mean, I did six and a half on those, and I was like, wow, you know, this is a really bad deal that I did, you know? And especially reading the reports, the victims standing out there, their families, I was like, wow, you know, I really hurt these people. I really hurt my community. I really hurt them, you know? And I learned, I'm not ever going to do something like this again, ever.
So you never had the urge to be with children before that or after?
Oh, no, you know, and I was abused as a kid too, you know, sexually and stuff like that. And I remember when I used to work at DHS, you know, and...
At the shelter?
Yes. Those little kids, you know, that used to come, I was real nice to them, you know, real positive to them. And there was one certain one that his dad would never do anything to him, you know, help him or anything, and... I would sit there, you know, I would fill up his bathtub, you know, and I would just be thinking, like, what am I doing here, you know? I remember my uncle doing things to me, you know, and then there was, like, this demon in my head telling me, you know, not to do anything, but, like, you know, recalling the memories, you know, and I felt bad inside. So it's not like I had these urges to do anything. I think this one thing was just that happened, and I learned my lesson from it.
My opinion is that he didn't have urges, you know, to be with these young girls or whatever. I think what he had is a lust problem, because it wasn't like, you know, he was flirting with young girls or anything like that. He was flirting with women. It doesn't make it right. It was very wrong. You know, if it was my daughter, he would still have gone to prison. So, you know, it's unfair to ask questions like, you know, did you have the urges, or would you do it again, or anything like that. In my eyes, it was a lust problem.
Yeah, and I'm asking the question because those are the questions he's going to face out in the world. This is his new reality because of this.
He committed the crime. You know, he's guilty, and now he has to wear that scarlet letter. I believe that he'll do great things with it, regardless.
Do you love him?
I do. Am I in love with him? You know, do I want to be his wife? You know, that's not my decision to make. And, you know, it would be a hard life, a life that I never asked for or never expected. And to have the strength to do it, you know, I would definitely, you know, have to have God carrying me through this relationship.
And you haven't had that message yet?
I haven't asked for it.
That's the voice of Juan Guerrero's ex-girlfriend, Rihanna Lindsay. How have things been going since he got out, Peter?
Well, he got a job. He's working nights at a produce factory. He starts college again today. He got a grant through a program that helps ex-convicts get back on their feet. He's trying hard, but he's struggling. When I was going through court records, I found a statement that Juan made to the judge after getting arrested. And he quoted Martin Luther King Jr. It was a line that said, "There is some good in the worst of us and some evil in the best of us." And I think that if we're honest with ourselves, we could probably all relate to that just a little bit. But for Juan, that is an idea that sort of follows him around in a pretty heavy way. And I think it will for a while.
That's Here Now's Peter O'Dowd. And again, you made an effort to contact Juan's victim or her family or someone to speak and be her voice. And we have not yet been able to do that.
That's right.
But we will follow the story. Peter, thank you.
You're welcome.
In January, Rachel Hager set a goal to collect 3,500 gently used bras for homeless women in Indianapolis. She expected it to take all year, but it took just 88 days, less than 3 months. She was inspired by a Washington, D.C.-based organization called Support the Girls, and now she's setting up branches around the country. Rachel Hager joins us from Indianapolis. Welcome.
Thank you.
And tell us about your original inspiration for this project.
I heard about a woman in Washington, D.C. named Dana Marlowe, who began a collection of bras for homeless and at-risk women in her community late 2015. And I decided on January 1st to do something similar, to go ahead and send some bras to her. And I just put a Facebook post saying, "In search of your bras," on my neighborhood buy-sell trade page. In that very first day, I collected 99 bras, and more were coming. And so I realized I had something going on. So I emailed Dana and told her what I had. And so we set up a call and decided that instead of sending them to D.C., I was going to continue to collect in Indianapolis. And it's just taken off like crazy.
How many bras have you collected so far?
So far, I have distributed 6,300 bras.
Wow. And when I think of the things that homeless women would need, I wouldn't have even thought of bras, but obviously there's a need.
That's a big part of why this is so important, is to raise the awareness, because there are so many women in need, and these are things that are often not donated.
And where do they come from, the bras that you're getting?
I've gotten them from everybody. All of my friends, family, neighbors, coworkers, strangers. People have been sending them from far and wide to P.O. boxes. And it's just wonderful. I've had all sorts of women collect for me.
And where do you donate these goods?
I started out donating around Indianapolis to local homeless and domestic violence centers. And since I have covered Indianapolis, I decided to spread out for the entire state of Indiana. So I've donated to shelters from Crown Point to Bloomington, Lafayette, Greenwood, all over.
And now to cities around the country.
Yes. So now I am working to get other women like myself up and running in cities around the country and actually world.
Why was this idea something that you wanted to devote so much time to?
You know, it's just – it's really important. I think that because bras, pads, and tampons are things that – women need for a huge part of their lives, but they're also things that are not seen. They're invisible. And so just to bring a little bit more awareness to those things, those basic necessities, is really important to me, and to be able to provide dignity to women.
But was there a personal connection that you had that really got you going on this?
I have a young daughter who is 3.5, and she has been with me every step of the way. And so to do something to help people in our community, to also support women, is very important for me to show her.
As you have done this, I assume you've met a lot of homeless women. What kind of people have you come across?
Well, homeless women, that's kind of a hard thing to talk about because, you know, a lot of these things are temporary. So I've met a lot of women who may have just been in a bad situation at that time. So, you know, a lot of women are just like me. They're moms. Some of them are wives. They're students. They're, you know, working women. They're all sorts of women.
That's Rachel Hager, who is the National Director of Affiliate Outreach for the organization Support the Girls. She's been collecting bras, collected thousands of them to distribute to homeless women. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Milwaukee's police chief Edward Flynn says the 24-year-old black officer who shot and killed an allegedly armed 23-year-old black man named Sylville Smith is now staying with relatives out of fear for his safety. Violent riots erupted after the shooting Saturday, crowds throwing rocks at police and burning down several businesses. The protests extended into last night when an 18-year-old was shot by an unknown assailant. Police rushed him to the hospital. NPR's David Shaper is in Milwaukee. David, what's it like now?
Well, there are no active protests going on right now during the daytime. There were several over the weekend, obviously some of them overnight, late at night, and on Saturday night got quite violent and quite disruptive with fires set and a couple of five, six businesses burned, a couple of them to the ground. There was, again, a lot of tension last night as the protests went deep into the night after midnight. But eventually, cooler heads did prevail. But there is still a lot of angst in this town. There is a lot of consternation over these really poor police-community relations and a feeling in the African-American neighborhoods here that they're targeted by police more often than they should be.
Well, in fact, we are hearing residents say that this has less to do with this shooting in which the suspect was allegedly armed, although people are upset about that, than with previous shootings, one in 2014, and long-term relations. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting that you know, this shooting kind of was the fuse that lit this bomb. There have been tensions here for quite some time. There was a shooting, you know, 2 years ago, as you mentioned, a man by the name of Dontre Hamilton, who was mentally ill and shot by a police officer in a city park. And that incident sparked a lot of protests at the time. But even since that time, in the 2 years since, there's just a lot of frustration, a lot of tension that goes on between police and members of the African-American community, particularly young black men who are finding opportunities hard to come by, whether they be educational or whether they be for jobs and a better way of life. And these tensions simmering under the surface just kind of exploded this weekend.
Yeah. Well, and we're hearing all sorts of voices, those who say that, you know, this is a result of long-term bad police relations, but others like Tony Whitley, who's with the Resurrection Life Worship Center, who says this is because of a generation of young people who've not been parented. We've grandparents in their 20s and 30s, and that's a problem. So, you know, people pointing to different, what they see as systemic problems. So short-term, long-term, to the short-term, when do we think we might see the camera video from the shooting?
Police said it could be later on this week. The mayor of Milwaukee, Tom Barrett, seems to want it to be released sooner rather than later. The police chief is a little more cautious and not sure that they'll release it that quickly, although it does appear it will be released. And that video, I think what many elected officials are hoping will show that the suspect who was shot and killed by police had a gun in his hand. That's what they say the video shows, and that might help, reduce the anger that is out there in the community and let folks in the community know that this appears to have been a good shooting by most police standards. However, there is always that concern, and I think this might be the police chief's concern, that once you release it and you show someone actually, you know, being shot, that that may stir up even more anger regardless of the circumstances.
Yeah. It's hard to see. Well, and then in the ensuing violence, the police chief went out of his way to point out that no officers ever used any force. There was no gunshots, no taser, no batons, no force by hand. They're hoping that that goes a long way. But it sounds as if there needs to be some sort of long-term plan for the city.
You know, it's really interesting that people are praising the police for showing a great deal of restraint in dealing with the protesters on the street, in having a strong police presence, in trying to move people off the street, particularly once it gets after midnight, 1 a.m., and they want these protests to quiet down, but not being confrontational, not going after people. At the same time, there are many people who are, even in the protest community, who are saying, we need to have some serious change. We need to have some serious dialogue. The violence of the other night is not the answer, but we do need to get people's attention, and we do need to sit down with one another and talk about how we move the city forward.
NPR's David Shaper in Milwaukee, talking about the police shooting and the protests in response. David, thank you.
Thank you for having me, Robin.
A Connecticut resident wants to make things safer for pedestrians on an historic road. US 1, the longest north-south highway in the country, running up and down the East Coast with at times as many as 6 lanes of traffic and few sidewalks. Once used by colonial postmen who rode horses to deliver the country's first newspapers between New York and Boston. Cassandra Basler from member station WSHU followed 75-year-old Ray Rout as he walked this busy highway through Connecticut to draw attention to the state's most dangerous road for pedestrians.
Ray Rout moved from New York City to Connecticut 30 years ago. He thought he was moving out to the country, but the roads near his home felt too dangerous for a quiet stroll. Rout leads me to the foot of a highway overpass in the town of Fairfield. It's wedged between a supermarket and a senior living center.
Look, they've got a crosswalk.
Cars shoot off Interstate 95 onto US 1 at about 50 miles an hour as we wait to cross.
I'm kind of not willing to chance it here.
And with good reason. Cars struck and killed 10 pedestrians on this road in Connecticut between 2012 and 2014. That's the most pedestrian deaths on any road in the state. Rout tells me this intersection is one of the scariest.
No one has slowed down for us despite the fact that you're wearing a neon shirt and look like you want to cross the street here.
Yes, yes, there's a crosswalk, but they're not required by law to stop until a pedestrian is in the crosswalk.
He believes a person should be able to walk or bike to any place they could get to by car.
There's just so much traffic. There's nowhere for people to go. And it was just never designed for pedestrians in mind.
That's Eric Jaffe. He drove US 1 from New York to Boston while writing his book on the history of the Boston Post Road called The King's Best Highway. Jaffe says US 1 became the nation's first highway in the 1920s. Then Interstate 95 replaced it a few decades later with unique celebrations.
The ceremony was actually officials dressed up in colonial garb, riding actually a buggy down this part of what would be I-95. Because they wanted to pay homage to the Post Road predecessor.
Neither of these highways were ever pedestrian-friendly. That new interstate, I-95, runs alongside US 1 and moves cars faster than 65 miles an hour onto exit ramps. US 1 became a local road lined with strip malls and gas stations, what Jaffe calls wall-to-wall retail junk. Tom Maziarz at the Connecticut Department of Transportation says the department's trying to shift its focus away from cars and drivers.
What we're facing here in virtually every state in the country is the need to gradually retrofit our existing roadway system. And we are doing that slowly but surely.
Connecticut passed a law in 2009 that requires road upgrades to include space for pedestrians and cyclists. When a town wants to, say, repave a road, it now has to consider shrinking traffic lanes, painting bike lanes, or adding sidewalks. Every state in New England has adopted a similar policy, except New Hampshire. But road changes happen town by town in Connecticut, so it appears the policy won't make US 1 better for pedestrians like Jalen McKenzie anytime soon. McKenzie collects wet grass clippings on his leather boots as he walks past shopping malls on the Post Road in the suburb of Milford.
They didn't want to finish the sidewalk, I guess.
Mackenzie walks a mile to work at a men's clothing store after traveling an hour on a bus. The sidewalk disappears and reappears from block to block.
Then I gotta like kind of maneuver into the street a little bit to get around the grass, and especially when it's raining, it doesn't make it much better either.
Mackenzie says Milford needs a real sidewalk. Not every town can afford that, but pedestrian advocate Ray Rout says some fixes come cheap. Enforcing speed limits and widening shoulders are both easy ways to keep walkers safe.
There are a lot of people that know the roads from the standpoint of a pedestrian or a cyclist. Their opinion should be asked for by the people that build the roads.
The State Department of Transportation is now rewriting its guidelines on how to build its highways. Rout has to wait for the public comment period to share his ideas. Ideas about how to make roads safe for pedestrians like him on their way to work or out for a country stroll. For Here and Now, I'm Cassandra Basler.
There is at least one area this election season in which there appears to be some agreement between the two presidential candidates. Listen to this.
We will put Americans to work, building and modernizing our roads, our bridges, our tunnels, our railways, our ports, our airports.
We will build the next generation of roads, bridges, railways, tunnels, seaports, and airports. That, believe me, folks, is what our country deserves.
Wow, pretty similar. That was, of course, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton speaking last week in their big economic speeches about infrastructure spending, both promising to spend tens of billions of dollars on infrastructure. Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. He joins us from New York, as he does each Monday. Hi, Derek.
Hey, Jamie.
Well, let's go through these very similar ideas here. First, to Hillary Clinton's plan, she promised to spend $275 billion over 5 years to improve infrastructure. What would that plan do? How would she pay for it?
That's right, $275 billion in the next 5 years to repair the roads and bridges and airports that she mentioned, and also $25 billion in government seed funding to invest in private sector infrastructure projects. So how will she pay? Well, she's proposed raising taxes on the rich, on the 1%, and closing business loopholes, a little bit vaguer there. But there's another way to pay for infrastructure, and that is simply to borrow the money. And it should be said here that the case for infrastructure spending right now is sort of a triple play. The U.S. will have to build its bridges and roads and repair them eventually, so you might as well do it when it's cheap to borrow now, when. There are still parts of the country where an alarming number of men still are out of work, and you could put them to work with government funding, win number two. And finally, people want to raise wages, and government investment in this industry could raise wages. So it is truly a win-win-win case.
And Donald Trump has promised to spend twice as much as Hillary Clinton on infrastructure. What's his plan?
That's right. His plan calls for twice the amount of spending, which could be a very good thing, although it probably has about half the specificity in terms of paying for it. Neither candidate, to be honest, is altogether that clear on exactly how to pay for these several hundred billion dollars. Trump in particular, though, it should be said, has said that he would be willing to deficit finance this or to create infrastructure bonds to essentially ask Americans to lend the government money, and then the government pays them back plus interest a few years later. So certainly in this respect, Trump is not a typical Republican.
We heard both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump mention the word railways. Now, the GOP's platform this year called for ending all federal funding of mass transit, saying that it serves only a small portion of the population concentrated in six big cities. How does what Trump's talking about fit into the Republican platform?
Well, it doesn't really. Donald Trump was born in one of those six cities. He still lives in one of those big six cities, New York City. But the fact is that his plan does not really fit into the Republican platform at all. The GOP has railed against the stimulus. It railed against infrastructure spending after the stimulus was passed. House Republicans have blocked the Obama administration's repeated attempts to pass even smaller infrastructure measures. So Trump, once again, is not in this case a typical Republican. That insight is not going to win me any sort of journalistic award, but he's basically a big government Republican. He's a bit of an old-fashioned Republican, maybe an Eisenhower Republican when it comes to infrastructure.
Why, Derek, and as you've looked into this issue, and we've talked to you about infrastructure before, why has it become so political?
It's a hard question. Eisenhower's Highway Act was one of the biggest infrastructure projects in American history. He was a Republican president. That was only 60, 70 years ago. But in the last three decades or so, the Republican Party, and particularly this conservative wing in the Congress, in the House, has become religiously opposed to basically any dime of additional government spending on anything, on research and development, on infrastructure, anything really except for the military. And so they've essentially left it to state governments to fund this stuff. But as we all saw in 2007 through 2010, state governments got absolutely pummeled by the Great Recession. And as a result, they essentially put things like infrastructure on the back burner. So what's needed right now are plans, are proposals to make up for the fact that we've missed some prime years to repair all these elements of infrastructure that both Clinton and Trump talked about.
Well, and it's interesting when you compare what's happening in this country to what's happening in other countries. We're going to hear tomorrow about a huge rail project that's going on in London to connect the western part all the way to the eastern part. They're doing it very quickly and for not that much money comparatively. But do you expect that the stuff that we're hearing from Clinton and Trump will actually happen?
I don't, as long as we have Republicans controlling the Congress. You know, it should be said that Trump is also proposing similarly outlandish infrastructure projects, like that big, beautiful wall that he talks about along the southern border. But at this point, infrastructure essentially remains in the realm of illusion when it comes to government finance. You have the president, you have Hillary Clinton, and now you have Donald Trump. The one thing they seem to agree on, the one thing they seem to sing in unison, is that we need hundreds of billions of dollars more infrastructure spending, but we're not going to get it as long as Republicans control the Congress.
Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And here now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here Now.